I'm going to do talk. Yeah, right. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Hooray!
Right. In your pockets or in your hands, you should have three sheets of A3 paper, which are put together with a tiny staple, top left-hand corner, so the wind will catch them and blow them across the hill. But if you can keep them under control, and if you're even better still able to open them, the talk will make slightly more sense. Because the most important thing about Brandon Hill, this is the alternative history of Brandon Hill, the most important thing about it is the view, and the view we get today has been buggered by a lot of trees that have been planted here. I don't want to hear any sympathy for trees. These trees should go, because they're interfering with your view of your city. And beyond that, a lot of high-rise modern developments, which also need to go, because they're also interfering with your view of your city, and we'll be demolishing those later. But if you look at the first sheet I gave you there, there's a print by Nathaniel and Samuel Buck, a couple of blokes who went around the country in the 1730s making these amazing sort of prospect views of English towns and cities. And this is their northwest prospect of the city of Bristol, and it shows you what Bristolians would have seen when they stood on Brandon Hill and looked out across the city in that direction, across at the old city. And the most important things that you could see then that we can't really see now are Queen Square, which I'll talk about in a moment. And if you look, I've got a sort of blown-up version of this picture at the top. So there's the big picture, and then above that there's a blown-up bit of the central area showing Queen Square itself. And the most remarkable thing about Queen Square, you'll see, is that it's completely surrounded on three sides by the masts of ships. Queen Square, to Bristolians, represented, or was supposed to represent, the shared commonwealth of the city. All right. It's surrounded by trade, it's built on the proceeds of trade, and trade has made us all very happy, wealthy and proud to be Bristolians, because we all share it, don't we? We all play our part, you know. So this was sort of, this idea that you could look out upon that and feel that this was the heart of your city, that trade represented the best interests of your city, and we all had this together. This was part of the point of standing on Brandon Hill, was to drink that in and feel something in common. I'll briefly read you this this fantastically terrible poem written in 1794 by a man called Romaine Thorne that sort of captures pretty well what that picture is representing. Thorne says, "To Brandon Hill, my journey I pursue, from whence Bristolia forms a pleasing view. Now on its summit, as I musing stray, I trace the spot where hostile Britons lay." He's referring there to the Civil War, when there was a bit of fighting up here. "But discord now and civil wars are over, and joy and commerce bless Bristolia's shore. Now from each quarter clouds of smoke appear, mount their black columns and dissolve in air, buildings superb, lofty spires surprise the gazer's senses and enchant his eyes." Goes on like this. Then he goes on about how you can hear the noise of trade and shopping and building and everything. And this is just a marvellous thing for Bristolians to feel. Good thing. So Brandon Hill is sort of brings Bristolians together and gives them an opportunity to look out over the city they collectively own. That's the first thing that's supposed to work here. And the other is that they all know that the hill belongs to them. It belongs to the people of Bristol, and it was given to the people of Bristol by Elizabeth I in the 16th century. And the corporation, the ruling council of the city, sort of given permission to look after it on their behalf. One of the things the corporation weren't allowed to do, they could manage it, they could even say they owned it if they liked on behalf of the people, but they could not build upon it, and they could not stop people coming onto it. And it is here, it's the green lungs of the 18th century city, even of the 17th century city, and that was really important. It was equally accessible to the rich, the top of the hill, of course, Berkeley Square, whatever it's called up there, which is an encroachment and ought to be pulled down, actually, but there we are. It was permitted at the time. And at the bottom, some of the houses of the poorest workers are just along the Hotwells Road and Limekiln Road, equally accessible to them as well. It's just straight up the hill from there. So it's just perched beautifully between the social classes in the city. The other thing about Queen Square, as we look down upon it, as we don't, but we would have done at the time and drunk it all in, not only is it surrounded by masts of ships, not only therefore does it represent trade, but it also represents the liberties that Bristolians are so proud of and that which they enjoy by walking about on the hill itself. It represents those liberties by the fact that it's got this lovely statue in the middle of William III, the monarch who came to us via the Glorious Revolution by invitation. and on sufferance, because should he interfere with the rights of Britons to be governed by Parliament, then he would be overthrown, of course, and removed like the last one. So he's our first constitutional monarch, and Bristolians are as keen on that as anybody else. And the square, therefore, with him in the middle of it, represents that kind of bringing together of political liberty guaranteed by his reign and the Bill of Rights that came with it. I don't know whether you know this, by the way, but the Bill of Rights, which was guaranteed by William III, is your right to bear arms in your defence against tyranny. That right was interfered with by some poaching laws in the 18th and 19th century. But until then, technically, you had a right, in fact, a patriotic duty, to bear arms in defence of your constitution and your liberties against tyranny and anyone who should raise their hand against you. That's a great thing to remember, I think. At various points, radicals in the 19th century remembered it whenever it was appropriate. And then argued, well, it's tyranny, isn't it? And you could say that it was. But the other thing about Queen Square, you look down on Queen Square and you would not only think about it in terms of liberty and trade and liberty and property and all that, but it's also incredibly regular and rational and a product of early 18th century architecture. The hill is entirely different. You can't tame the hill. The hill is wild and open and unadorned, and you know, it was everything that Queen Square wasn't in many ways. Now, the hill throughout the 18th century enjoyed a sort of a mixed use, because it belonged to all Bristolians. Wealthy people took their exercise upon it, and poor people picked their pockets. You know, that was kind of par for the course. The corporation used it to fire cannon from and light bonfires on whenever there was a royal anniversary or a royal wedding. Anything was meant to unite us in our sense of patriotism. In 1771, they brought a deserting soldier up to the top and shot him dead. Brandon Hill thought to be the right place to do that. And when the Grand Exchange, the big exchange building in Corn Street, was opened in 1744, again they held a big celebratory bonfire up here to bring everyone together about that. But there were also popular events on the hill throughout the century, which no one ever did very much to prevent. So in the early 18th century, those who wanted to protest about Hanoverian rule, about the reign of the first Georges, came up here, the Jacobites, they protested up here and held sort of revels up here with impunity. In 1745, the sailors down on the docks and on the quay went on strike for better conditions of work and wages and marched up here to make their demands on their masters. This was the Palladium of their liberties, so this is where they came to. And started the ball rolling for a sort of a series, I suppose, of, you know, sort of continuous usages of the hill for those sort of purposes. But it's the intervention of the French Revolution in the 1790s sort of makes the hill for the first time a more contestable space, a space which has to be fought over. And it is at that point that the authorities in the city begin to start trying to stop people using it any old way they like. It is partly because one of the things the French Revolution did was reopen the book on what we consider the meaning of rights to be, right? The rights to walk around, hang up washing on bushes, beat carpets and take your exercise are all very well. But the French Revolution, of course, suggested we had more rights than that. And they're not rights founded in property, they're not rights founded in some sort of grand historical precedent. They're rights founded in citizenship, in the right to have some control over your daily life. And so by opening that book, what happens is a number of Bristolians begin to think to themselves, well, you know, actually, the whole basis of a civic community held together by a merchant elite and a corporation who have only earned their power and authority through wealth, through money, through trade, through the slave trade, and by ripping off everybody else, isn't necessarily a good basis for government or a good basis for pride. So, I mean, the French Revolution gets people thinking in different ways about their rights and their privileges and the way that they should be exercising them.
That was 1789,
and throughout the 1790s, that's going on, yeah. And apart from anything else, of course, actually by the 1790s, the great sort of trading commonwealth that we were all supposed to be feeling a part in was starting to decline in any case. So people began to look upon the corporation and the merchant venturers as people who were past their sell-by date, losing the plot, not really worth venerating any longer. So we started looking for new ways of building civic pride, and that's pride based upon different formulations of liberty and freedom. So what happens in the 1790s is that radical meetings demanding the rights of man, demanding reform, a proper reform of parliament, universal suffrage and so on, begin to be excluded from public buildings and private buildings in the city, so that radicals need to come out in the open air in order to organise, in order to find a space where they can work and be effective. So from the 1790s onwards, the Hill becomes, as what one radical called it, a folk moot for Bristol. It becomes a sort of the folk moot of the city. It becomes famous for public political meetings, it is said, at another point in the 1820s. On the second page of the sheet I gave you, there's a couple of photocopies of posters, both advertising meetings that were held on the Hill after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, when there's a sort of a revived radical initiative to get parliamentary reform and reduce taxation and all that kind of thing. One of them is a Boxing Day meeting held here in 1816 by Henry Hunt. That's the man who was on the platform at Peterloo before the soldiers charged in and butchered everybody. And the other is a commemorative meeting held in 1819 about the Peterloo massacre and to protest about it. And I mean, there are hundreds of these. They're good examples, I suppose, but they're quite interesting to keep, these sort of things. The Hill began to assume even greater significance for people in Bristol. It was already gathering a reputation as a radical meeting place, but it began to assume an even greater significance for Bristolians once the corporation tried to stop radicals from gathering in Queen Square. I mean, Queen Square was always intended to be a place where wealthy people paraded around and made marriage settlements and did business deals. Of course, that's the kind of place it is. The wealthy lived on all four sides of it. The merchants had their meeting house there. You know, that was the kind of place it was. But of course, it was an open place, and like Brandon Hill then, it was a place which people could resort to as an open public space. It's just that the corporation liked to try to prevent people from using it for inappropriate purposes. So in 1823, for example, the corporation hit on this great plan of actually filling in the middle of Queen Square with civic buildings. That was just one way of stopping people from gathering in it, but it was thought that would be a bit of a shame, so it wasn't done. And then in 1830, they hit on the master plan. They said, I'll tell you what we'll do, we'll use Queen Square, we'll turn Queen Square into a kind of a very civic place. We'll turn it into a place which is more in control of the authorities in the city, and we'll do that by making it the place where we hold all our general elections. It'll be a kind of a big sort of civic theatre for electoral politics, and it becomes very respectable as a result, and very official, and very recognised, and very okay. Because by 1830, radicalism had become sort of acceptable in any case, and elections were fought on a reform ticket. So there was a sense in which a certain kind of radicalism, a desire for political reform, was no longer ruled out of court, and radicals didn't need necessarily to sort of resort to Brandon Hill in order to be seen.
Does that mean radicalism in this context would be defined as wanting to promote social change and democratic change of the constitution?
Yeah. But in 1830, the main drive is just to acquire political reform, so to acquire the right to vote, mostly for men of an adult age. So it means that the Hill became slightly less obvious a resort for radicals, I suppose. But of course, all that went out the window during the 1831 riots, because, of course, it was Queen Square which the people resorted to and made their headquarters during the riots. It was Queen Square which was burnt down on three sides, which didn't show a great deal of respect for mercantile power and elite governance. But of course, the one thing they did show great respect for was William III, our great guarantor of liberties, who wasn't just not pulled down and not thrown into the river or not burnt up or melted, but William III was decorated with a tricolour, representing French republicanism. After 1831 riots, the Queen Square is not considered to be the best place to take a radical meeting. Well, you just can't. I mean, it's just, you can't do it. It won't be allowed. So the Hill is the only place you can really reasonably resort to, which is why in 1832, when the Reform Act was finally passed, the victorious, and these are, you know, middle-class victors, very respectable middle-class victors of the 1832 Reform Act, having now secured the vote for themselves and their mates, but not for anybody else, decide to celebrate the Reform Act in August 1832 by holding a grand Reform banquet up here on the People's Hill. What more appropriate place could there possibly be to hold it? And I suspect most people in the city would have thoroughly supported it if only they hadn't decided to exclude most Bristolians by putting a bloody great fence all around the hill, effectively therefore enclosing it, allowing only 6,000 respectable tradesmen to take part in the banquet, and they only if they could afford 2 and 6 entrance ticket, and if they had a letter of recommendation from a benefit society to say they were respectable and not troublemakers. Yeah, a bit like that. So they set up these great tables and they have a nice plinth for the two victorious new Whig MPs to make celebratory speeches from. They lay out the dinners, and while 6,000 tradesmen are queuing up to come in, the poor and dispossessed down on the Hotwells Road and in Limekiln Road and all around there just barged down the barricades, knocked the fences down, swarmed up onto the hill. According to newspaper accounts, something like 14,000 Bristolians reappropriated the hill from their oppressors, pinched all the puddings, mixed all the beer. That beer was seen rolling in barrels all the way back down the Hotwells Road. We'll have a cider rolling contest afterwards.
What about the pudding?
And the puddings were taken as well. Everything was mixed. Women were seen dancing on tables in an unseemly manner. Everyone got drunk. And on the last page of the sheets I gave you, there's a wonderful lithograph of the chaos that ensued when the people overtook the Reform dinner. It's not a sympathetic lithograph. It's made by someone who's obviously just trying to suggest that any if you give reform, if you give an inch of reform to people who demand it, we'll end up with total chaos. So it's just a reform banquet at which people get drunk, fight, hit one another over the head with legs of mutton, and throw plates in the air, and they fill their hats with beer. It's a lovely picture, nevertheless. Well, after that, of course, there were a series of attempts by the authorities to continue the great work of preventing unseemly audiences from meeting on the hill. There are sort of these proposals are suggested. One bloke suggests that we could have a big cemetery up here. It could be a cemetery. Well, because this was before they opened the big one up by the HTV studios. And they were looking for a new cemetery site, and they thought this would be an appropriate place. It'd be like Père Lachaise in France, they thought, but without Jim Morrison. And then that was thrown out of court, and then they decided, well, I'll tell you what we could do. We could keep it as a park. Because all these schemes for improvement did fall in there, they floundered in the end on the corporation getting cold feet over the fact that you can't build on the hill, it belongs to the people, and we must have the right to beat our carpets and hang up our washing and walk and do other stuff. So they thought, well, we'll turn it into a park. Because a park could be quite a nice, genteel and respectable space. All we have to do is, we'll put some small fences around it and we'll charge people to come in, but it'll still be a park. You know, because that was ruled out as well. That didn't work out. In the end, the corporation was rather compromised by the fact that Durdham Down was under threat of enclosure. Now, Durdham Down, up on the other side of Clifton, was where the very wealthy went to parade around on horseback and then have a pleasant Sunday afternoon stroll. Working people, well, it was far too far for them to go. Not many of them lived in Clifton. But when it was suggested that Durdham Down be enclosed and used for allotments, which seemed like quite a good idea, the corporation sort of jumped in and went, no, you can't do that. That's where people go to exercise. You can't do that. So, of course, if they then went around the following week and said, mind you, but you could probably close off Brandon Hill and do something for that because that's just full of plebeians, it just made them look rather hypocritical and silly. So that was dumped. There's a great letter written to the Bristol Mercury about that in, 1832. Where the letter writer says, no sooner is it discovered that Durdham Down might be enclosed, than all the gentry go up in arms at the crying injustice of the measure. No sooner is it proposed to enclose Brandon Hill, than they all cry, what a good idea! What a beautiful spot it will make! Durdham may be said to be a place of enjoyment for the aristocracy of the neighbourhood, because it's out of the way of the poor, but Brandon Hill is a convenient place of resort for the mechanic in his spare moments, and the rich are not. comparatively speaking, very often seen there. So, it ends up, well, throughout the 1830s, they find it very difficult to improve it or to change it. Which means that the National Union of the Working Classes in the late or mid 1830s are able to hold political meetings up here without any trouble. The Chartists use it, in 1838 to 39, the Chartists were holding torchlight meetings up here on the hill almost on a weekly basis, without any trouble, without any interference. What can the corporation do? Well, what they do two things. One is they build a police station. It's just down there, isn't it? It's now the headquarters of the Avon Wildlife Group, I think. But it was built as a police station in 1836 to try to control activity on the hill. And the other thing that the corporation did was they started almost, I imagine, while there were radicals holding meetings here, the corporation are walking past and going, excuse me, sorry, just laying out a gravel path. Sorry, just planting a shrubbery. Sorry, excuse me, we're going to put a pond here, but you just carry on. So all that stuff you see behind you was put up, it began, the rot set in the sort of late 1830s, early 1840s. I mean, it's very nice, but don't be fooled. You know, the reason it was put there was to stop people holding political meetings on top of the hill. I'm not saying it's not lovely, but it does have a sort of political cost. So all that's going on while the radical meetings are still taking place. And of course the process was completed, I suppose, in the 1890s, when that great phallic mercantile excrescence, Cabot's Tower, was dumped right on the top. Do you ever think of a more symbolic way of reappropriating the hill from the people by the mercantile classes than dumping that bloody great thing on top of it? Well, it just says it all, really, doesn't it? And of course I love that too, it's lovely. You can sit on top of it and look out, and I'm not really knocking it, but it comes with a political price, and you have to appreciate the what it meant when it was put there. All these things have a meaning, don't they? So very briefly, during the 1860s, despite the fact that the park was now here, it was still open and free to get in, and so political meetings were successfully held here. In 1860 itself, we find 12,000 to 15,000 members of the Gas Workers Union and the railway unions met up here to protest the high price of bread. And petition Parliament and organise boycotts of bakers and so on. In 1866, when the Second Great Reform Act was mooted, the working classes held political meetings up here, night after night. And I love this. This is the final parting shot, really. But in 1924, not so long ago, Bristol City Council held a historical pageant, where people dressed up as Cabot and marched about going, I say, and you know, celebrating the history of the city. But they did a number of reenactments of important events in the city's history, only about five reenactments. And one of them was Elizabeth I coming to the city and granting Brandon Hill to a bunch of washerwomen who were then seen holding up their laundry and putting it on the bushes. And I don't know whether this was photographed, it certainly should have been. But anyway, that was an enactment and a historic moment in the history of the city in 1924. And isn't it a funny thing that in 2007 we've sort of almost forgotten what the symbolic meaning of the hill is. And I'll leave you with that thought. That's it, really. Thank you.
I've got one little question. Can you tell us about when the Chartists were coming up here, they built this police station?
Yeah.
Right, didn't the Chartists have some kind of response to that?
Yeah, Well, what happens is that Chartists meet, because there's a police station right on the hill, the police can sort of come in and out of that all the time to attempt to sort of police the meetings. So you've got policemen standing in sort of great crowds all around the Chartist meeting, just sort of intimidating people and trying to prevent them gathering. So the Chartists responded by organising their own police force. There was a Chartist police force who were equipped with staves, whose job it was to go around and intimidate the policemen when they arrived. Which, I don't know whether there was any real trouble, but there was obviously a bit of kind of pushing and shoving and jockeying for position. And I think it was probably a good idea to incorporate and set up another Chartist police force, isn't it?
I think you, when I read Steve Rowe's essay about it, one of the terms he used was something like reverse discipline or something. The Chartist cell was actually to discipline the police and not all new people, obviously.
That's right, yeah.
Is there anybody else got any questions then?
Okay, I missed a bit of what the first use of the hill was. Was it just a common area because they couldn't build on it, or what?
Yeah, it's always been an open common area. But Elizabeth I was the monarch who came here in the 16th century, in the 1520s, 30s, something like that, and formally said to the city of Bristol, this hill is yours. I suppose until then it would be assumed royal land, so she kind of hands it over to the city, but so that particular things can take place upon it and Bristolians can do what they like.
So can you still hang your washing up
there? Yeah, you can still hang your washing on it. If you'd like to hang your washing on it.
It's still common land.
It's not technically common land, no. It's owned by the city council. But they hold it in trust for you, and you should be able to do what the hell you like on it. Elizabeth I would be pretty upset, I think, if you were prevented from doing what you liked.
You can graze here.
I don't know whether you can graze.
Common land, you can often graze.
Yeah, you can on common land, yeah. I mean, it's worth a go, you know.
give it a go.
I suppose what I'm interested in is, was there a definition of people? So, this was for the people of Bristol. But 18th century, 19th century idea, who would constitute the people? It was a sort of contested thing, wasn't it? Working people who didn't own any property and worked for a living often weren't regarded as being part of the people. People were property owners who were going to identify a stake in some way. And I just wonder if that idea, who was the people
the idea was that open spaces like this one were represented your stake, however much property you held, in the commonwealth of the city. I mean, that was the... You know, it's all about keeping people on side, isn't it, really? And trying to get them, persuade them, that the riches made by the wealthy few somehow trickle down to all the people without property who have to live in the place and work in the place. You know. I don't quite know why such a fuss was made about hanging up washing, actually. But you'll see it in the print on the first page I gave you. There's people on the left hand side hanging up their washing. So this is always kind of emphasised. This is something you can do here.
They probably weren't hanging up their own washing. I mean, it was probably people using it as a laundry business,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yeah, it was certainly used as a laundry business.
So you could use it was wherever your business washing someone else's.
You could, yeah. You could, and people did. And I found that there's an account of laundry women coming up here with sledge loads of sheets and towels and shirts and trousers, you know, and hanging them all up by the sledge.
Any other questions, Ab? Drink the cider as you want. But just to say thanks again to Steve for doing that talk. Give him a big round of applause again.
Hey.
And I don't know where there's anybody. I just want to see if I'm going to wear Craig.